On this week's program, we listen back to four recent features from the Culture File section at gophila.com. We'll visit Philadelphia's Civil War and Underground Railroad Museum. Almost 30 years after they created Franklin Court, we take a tour of the 1976 Ghost House with architects Robert Venturi and Denise Scott Brown. And Susan Lewis visits Camden's Adventure Aquarium and explores Chester County's historic Yellow Springs. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.
To begin our program this week, we're going to play a word association game. Ready?
Ready.
Okay. I say Philadelphia, you say...
Cheesesteak.
Okay, okay. Maybe you do, but you probably also think history. You know, the Liberty Bell, Independence Mall, and tons of museums. This is one of the beauties of the city, tons of museums, both big and small, old and new. Okay, now another word association game. I say Civil War, you say...
Gettysburg.
Okay, sure, but what about I say Civil War, you say... What were we just talking about?
Philadelphia?
Yep, Philadelphia. The city was one of the major forces in the abolitionist movement and the home to many of the soldiers who fought in the war. In fact, Philadelphia is still home to the oldest Civil War museum in the country, founded in 1888 by a group of former Union officers.
We are the least well-known Civil War museum, I think, in America, and we're absolutely interested in changing that.
John Rum is executive director of the Civil War and Underground Railroad Museum in Philadelphia. Over the past couple of years, the museum has expanded its focus beyond the political stories of the war to personal battles for freedom fought by so many during this time. Rum says you can't tell the story of Philadelphia in the Civil War without telling the story of the Underground Railroad.
Philadelphia really was the birthplace of the Underground Railroad, that it was the key center of American abolitionism before the Civil War. In the decades immediately around the American Revolution and up through the early 19th century, Philadelphia was a seat of agitation about abolition, about the anti-slavery movement, and not just Quakers, as many people understand, but also free blacks. There was a very dynamic free black community here.
However, the story of the Underground Railroad is not easily told through a museum collection, as Education and Community Outreach Coordinator Millicent Sparks explains.
There's not a lot of materials that are available in terms of, like, the Underground Railroad. Enslaved Africans weren't running carrying things to stick in a museum later on.
But even pointing out a fact like this to visitors encourages them to think about the truths of slavery and the risks faced by those seeking freedom. Millicent Sparks also does extensive programming with living history actors. She herself greets school groups as Harriet Tubman and even takes the show on the road to prisons and rehabilitation centers. In the role of one of history's most important heroines, Sparks Tubman reminds people of the struggles of the past, hoping that they won't take the present for granted.
You didn't just pop up here out the ground as a slave. You came from Africa. You were enslaved. You were kidnapped and brought here. And even with all of that, and all of those years in slavery, you managed to free yourself without education for the most part, you know, without rights, without citizenship, certainly. But you managed to free yourself. And look where you are now. How dare you not do what you can do, free.
Telling the story of the Civil War is done mostly through artifacts, sometimes unlikely ones. The four-story Center City townhouse has the dusty feel of an eccentric collector's home. When entering, visitors are greeted by the museum's somewhat unusual mascot. Assistant curator Andrew Cauldron gestures to the front of the room.
That is Old Baldy. Now, Old Baldy was George Gordon Meade's horse, one of his horses during the war.
George Meade was a revered general in the Civil War and later the commissioner of Philadelphia's Fairmount Park. Old Baldy was Meade's favorite horse and even marched in the general's funeral procession. The great war horse lived 10 years longer than the great general. But when the Civil War veterans who started this museum's collection heard the horse had passed, they wanted to save his memory, and they went through great lengths to do so.
They decided it would be fun to have Old Baldy and stuff him. So they took a trolley up to Jenkintown to get Old Baldy's body and bring it back. Well, by the time they got up there, they discovered that Old Baldy had already been buried. So they dug him up, And they realized, now, we don't know too much of the specifics of this story, but it's hard to imagine these guys weren't a little in their cups. They decided that they couldn't carry old Baldy back, so they cut his head off, and they brought his head back on the trolley. And there he is, stuffed him, and he's been with the GAR Post and with us ever since.
Many of the collections were acquired and donated by this group of Philadelphia-based veterans. The rest was given by families later. Because of this, the collection is mostly Union, but there is a small room dedicated to the Confederate Army. Mostly things picked up in the field, or in the case of former Confederate President Jefferson Davis, acquired after he was captured. On display is Davis's purple paisley smoking jacket and one of his cigars in a plastic tube marked for evidence. There's a whole room dedicated to Abraham Lincoln, with paintings and busts, even a lock of his hair contained in, what else, a locket. Of course, the museum also has some typical war museum stuff, guns, swords, and uniforms, but it also has more personal belongings, which tell more personal stories. A handmade calfskin bag, watercolors of landscapes, and love letters home. Executive Director John Rum says it's these personal touches that make this museum different.
I want people to understand this is not your father's Civil War museum. This really isn't. I want a museum that can appeal to all people, because I think it's really about who we are as human beings, the things that we are capable of doing. We were capable of tolerating slavery, which is a terrible blot on our nation's history, but we were also capable of finding it within ourselves to end slavery.
The Civil War and Underground Railroad Museum of Philadelphia plans to move forward with its mission of telling the individual stories of the war and the struggle for freedom in a new, as yet undisclosed, location. Rum will say that they will remain in Philadelphia. In the meantime, General Meade's horse, Old Baldy, will continue to guard the collection at 1805 Pine Street in Center City, Philadelphia. Camden, New Jersey's State Aquarium closed in 2004 after 12 years of operation. It reopened a year later after extensive renovations and expansion. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis makes a splash at Adventure Aquarium as it celebrates its first birthday and 1 millionth visitor.
If you've ever been to one, you know that a public aquarium, at its most basic level, is a big fish pond or ponds, although human-made and actually quite tricky to operate. You could think of it as a museum or gallery whose collection has come to life. A public aquarium must handle a dicey combination of electricity and all that water, both fresh and salt water, which rusts everything and eats away at metal and concrete. And for those of us who may have had trouble keeping a goldfish alive, the idea of maintaining a healthy home for sea life ranging from tiny tropical fish to 400-pound stingrays and 10-foot sharks seems quite challenging, to say the least. But it turns out that aquariums can not only keep fish and sea creatures alive, they breathe new life into struggling neighborhoods, and in recent years have become key components in urban renewal efforts, as Peggy Amsterdam, president of the Greater Philadelphia Cultural Alliance, describes.
Retail followed the Baltimore Aquarium and office space in the whole revitalization of the Inner Harbor.
Baltimore's experience awakened other cities to the value of their own waterfronts. The New Jersey State Aquarium opened in 1992 and became one of the most visited sites in the region. Plans in 2003 to develop 30 acres of Camden's waterfront property contained as a central component a $33 million renovation and expansion of the aquarium. Adventure Aquarium opened last year and is now an accredited member of the American Zoological and Aquarium Association, as explained by Executive Director Greg Charbonneau.
What that means is we uphold a certain level of standards in terms of animal care, animal welfare, animal training, financial responsibilities, but also, more importantly, education, conservation, and research.
Promoting conservation and research dovetails with the aquarium's efforts to distinguish itself as an innovator in its field.
We're the only aquarium in the world that showcases hippopotamus in our West African River experience. We're also only one of two aquariums in North America to showcase bluefin tuna. We have sea dragons. We also participate in a survival species program for African penguins. We also showcase endangered sea turtles and threatened sea turtles. So part of our mission is to showcase animals and educate our guests on the conservation of these species, conservation of their environment, and in fact, send the message that what we do here in Camden, New Jersey can affect what goes on up in the Arctic or any other place in the world.
In Adventure Aquarium, a new wing joins a renovation of the old structure, and the combined 2,000-square-foot facility home to more than 6,000 creatures, stretches out along the Delaware River. Visitors enter through the doors facing the water, which on the day we visit is sparkling in the springtime sunshine. After picking up a map and a schedule of the day's shows, from feedings to informative talks to films in the movie theater, you can meander through hallways with individual windows into different forms of sea life, explore the renovated ocean realm, or head for the new highlighted attractions, like the African River Experience, a space where over 20 species of free-flying birds live, as the aquarium's Bill Larson describes.
We have everything from Abdim storks to lovebirds to cattle egrets. We have whistling ducks. And all of these are found on an African river.
60,000 gallons of water simulate the river. Down a slope and around the corner, we come to a viewing area where we can see underwater. Over 1,000 brightly colored fish swim along with two very large, nearly 3,000-pound female hippos who bob and seem to dance their own underwater ballet. Jenny and Button, whom we are told you can tell apart by the length of their noses, are logical, if not typical, aquarium residents, says Director of Husbandry Denise Aston.
Most people don't think of hippopotamus in an aquarium. It's kind of a new cutting-edge idea, but they do spend 80 to 90% of their life in the water, so why not have them in an aquarium?
Through the darkened submarine setting of the Jules Verne Gallery, with portholes into the homes of Japanese giant spider crabs, eerily suspended jellyfish, and other deep-sea creatures, waits another hot, if cold-blooded, attraction. Here we find ourselves walking under, over, and through what looks like a central casting call for Jaws, the 550,000-gallon seawater home of real-life, silently gliding, toothsome sharks, as Bill Larson describes.
We have three types of sharks here. We have sandbar, sand tiger, and nurse sharks. This tunnel, which is 40 feet, is completely surrounded by water, so it's suspended. So when people walk through this tunnel, they really are in their world, and we're observing them. And they're observing us because they can see through this acrylic.
Watching and being watched in this clear tunnel feels about as intimate as some of us would want to get with a tank full of sharks. But for those 12 years old and over who want more excitement, the aquarium offers opportunities to swim with the sharks, along with seven other adventure experiences. Oh, and if you're somewhere in the middle between just watching and actually jumping into the water with sharks, there's always the exhibit over by the Ocean Realm, where you can reach out and touch smaller sharks that swim in a wading-sized pool. On our visit, we decided just to ask someone else what a shark feels like.
Rubbery.
There's lots more sea life in the building, and the exhibits also spill outdoors, where you can visit Penguin Island or watch some seals at the seashore. At least a spot designed to mimic it. Turns out the Jersey Shore is popular not only with Philadelphia area humans, but with seals from up north during the colder months of the year, according to senior biologist Michelle Pagel.
It's pretty much like how people will vacation in Florida during the wintertime. You know, it's kind of their version of a winter vacation.
Nearly 1 year after opening, Adventure Aquarium has become one of the region's most visited attractions. Just recently, it welcomed its 1 millionth visitor. And they say that the aquarium is well on its way to fulfilling its mission as a world-class aquarium and a community treasure.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. You're listening to a Creatively Speaking compilation of recent features from the Culture File section of GoPhila.com. I'm Jim Cotter. In 1976, as part of the bicentenary celebrations, the National Park Service commissioned world-renowned architects Robert Venturi and Denise Scott Brown to design a museum on the site of Benjamin Franklin's Philadelphia residence just off Market Street. Instead of trying to recreate Franklin's house, the architects decided on a less conventional approach. They created a ghost house, a metal carcass that outlined the shape and dimensions of Franklin's home, with portals through which could be seen the Franklin's privy pits, wells, and the foundations of the house. Franklin Court was in turn the inspiration for a ballet created by Christopher D'Amboise for Pennsylvania Ballet in 1989. It's now being revived by the company. In this, the 30th anniversary of the structure, I met recently at Franklin Court with its creators, the architects Robert Venturi and Denise Scott Brown.
As we worked on it, we thought that putting a building on the site wasn't a very good idea and wasn't necessary. First of all, the excavation had been done of the building itself, and we knew that there was no way of reproducing that building. And the only remains that there were of the plan and actually kitchen middens in the basement, which are underwhelming. So it didn't seem as if putting back that much would be a very good idea. Then we had the idea that urbanistically this site could be something for the neighborhood, something open where people could come and eat their lunch. And to my great joy, sitting here one day, I saw someone just walking across with his briefcase. He used it as a shortcut. And that's wonderful when things like that happen as well. And so using it as an urban site and putting the museum underground seemed to make a good deal of sense, particularly because the museum was, in fact, to have no windows. So it all went together very well. We had to allow for large crowds, and this could certainly do that. Then, as for the ghost that you see here, I think Bob should describe how that happened.
Sure. So, Bob, firstly, when you unveiled your plans for this ghost structure, what was the reaction?
Surprisingly, it was well received. The client, who was the National Park Service, were agreeable. And the ghost structure evolves out of the excavations that had been made concerning the house. So we all knew the plan of the house, the extent of the house, as a result of analyzing the foundations. And at the same time, you could look down through these little look-through elements and see the actual excavations and some aspects of that. But the ghost structure we loved very much from the beginning, and it's an idea we got very early in our thinking, saying, oh, we do need some kind of iconic element here that you take away with you that identifies this place as the site of Benjamin Franklin's house sitting within the block. And so we hope this has worked, and we think it has, as a kind of sculptural element that identifies this place and signifies this place and is, as I said, an icon within the this part of the city.
There was no pictorial record of what actually stood here beforehand.
It is very significant that there was no record, and that's why the house could not be reconstructed. We worked with wonderful scholars at the time and historians, and there was some description of the house. There were some indications that derived from insurance contracts that he had concerning a house. But this evolves out of some verbal information we have and from the archaeological elements below grade. And it's an irony that there remains evidently no illustration of Benjamin Franklin's house.
But a very important written record was the letter writing between Franklin and France and his wife. Here. And so if you see photographs of this building and people are looking down at the floor, it's because we've taken excerpts from those letters and put them where they belonged to give you a word picture at any rate. It says over here, in the front room which I have designed for guests, I have the bed which you sent from England, a chamber mahogany table and stand. And that's Deborah Franklin to Ben Franklin, fall 1765. Lots like that. And this was the first time we had the idea of putting writing in a landscape. That's a theme that we've used now many other places. For example, in the Welcome Park, where it celebrates William Penn, and also in Washington for Western Plaza.
You spoke earlier about the fact that the first time you sat here and to see if it was working, you saw somebody walk through with a briefcase who was using it as a shortcut. Do either of you now return here at any time and see how it's being used by people today, 30 years later?
Alas, we do not, because we are such workaholics. We just work. We have to travel a lot. We've just returned from 3 weeks in China. So we work 7 days a week. We are in the office, and we really don't do pleasant things like this. Another thing is, I'm standing here, I'm reminded by and liking very much all of the variety beyond this space.
Yes.
And that's part of the Philadelphia scene, where you have the rigidity and the consistency of the gridiron plan established by William Penn. But then within that plan, all sorts of things could happen. There's no hierarchy. It could evolve over time, and it could be, again, Americanly and Philadelphian-like, and especially Franklin-like, full of contradictions and tensions and variety.
Architects Robert Venturi and Denise Scott Brown, creators of Franklin Court, More information on Franklin Court and all of today's features can be found at the Culture File section of gophila.com. Now Susan Lewis takes us on a trip to historic Yellow Springs.
What do the Lenape Native Americans, George Washington, Swedish Nightingale singer Jenny Lind, Pennsylvania Impressionist painter Daniel Garber, and actor Steve McQueen have in common? They lived very different lives at very different times, but all were drawn at one time or another to a meadow of wetlands in the Pennsylvania countryside. So today, when you pull up to the intersection of Yellow Springs and Art School Roads, you can conjure the ghosts of communities of people that have called this place home, or a home away from home. This is historic Yellow Springs. Yellow Springs was put on the map as early as 1722. The idea that water could cure was part of both Native American and European traditions. As English, Welsh, Irish, and Germans settled the land in Chester County, word spread about waters that were magical, healing, and very yellow.
My daughter, who's about 2 years old, calls it the icky water, which it does look pretty icky, but this is where the name Yellow Springs came from.
Rob Lukens is the executive director of Historic Yellow Springs, a nonprofit group dedicated to preserving and restoring the land and buildings that grew up around the springs here in the Pickering Creek watershed. We walk around the grounds where there are actually three separate springs, each with different mineral content. The iron-colored Yellow Spring gurgles in a gazebo. The sulfur spring, once used for bathing, is sheltered by what's now called the Jenny Lind Springhouse. The last discovered in the mid-1800s is the magnesium spring, now protected in the Crystal Diamond Springhouse, where Rob Lukens unlocks the door.
This is the one spring that is nice and clear and looks like you'd actually want to get into it. And this is the one that it's called the Crystal Diamond Spring because of the, you see little bubbles that are coming up from the bottom of the spring. And they look like little diamonds that are sparkling in the water. This spring actually, for many, many years, supplied all the water for the entire village up until, I believe it was about the 1970s. And I just had a little taste the other day, not in here, but outside, and it still does taste really good, actually.
Back in the mid-1700s, entrepreneurs built a tavern and operated bathhouses, which drew visitors from as far as the West Indies. Archivist and former executive director, Sandy Momeyer, says that even a trip from Philadelphia could take a while, depending on the stops.
There were packet boats that came up the Schuylkill River, and at Norristown they could take a stagecoach, and they would come out through Norristown, Phoenixville, Kimberton, to the Yellow Springs here.
During the Revolutionary War, Yellow Springs became temporary headquarters for General Washington, and in 1778, the site of the nation's first military hospital, a large three-story structure with wraparound porches on the hillside above the wetlands. Although the building was destroyed by fire in 1962, we can visit the ruins and an herb garden growing herbs like those used in soldier care. This hospital, says Director Rob Lukens, was a critical factor in the war effort.
You really can't tell the story about the Revolutionary War in Chester County, the Revolutionary War in general, Valley Forge, without talking about this hospital, because this was the best medical facility, the first medical facility that served soldiers during the American Revolution.
After the war, the spa reopened, turned the hospital into additional lodging, and built shelters for the springs. The fashionable resort attracted prominent statesmen like James Madison and Daniel Webster. With both health and recreational facilities, it had, says archivist Sandy Momeyer, something for everyone.
At one point, there were actually two separate hotels. One was supposed to be for those who were conscious of their health and wanted a quiet environment to heal. And the other place was promoted as a place where there was fine dining, wonderful spirits, fine dancing and music. So it was very, very social. So social to the fact that the local meeting house of Quakers in Euclid sent out a directive to all of their members and said that they were to keep their children away from the Yellow Springs Spa because promiscuous activity took place there. Then it meant card playing and dancing. And of course, I think we all have a different definition now.
Yellow Springs closed during the Civil War and afterwards was converted to one of eight boarding schools established by the Commonwealth to educate children left fatherless or orphaned. After the orphan school closed in 1912, education at Yellow Springs continued, but in a different form. Keeping pace with the Impressionist movement, Philadelphia's Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts purchased the property in 1916. Put in a bog garden, and converted the large 18th century barn to a studio. Sally Ritter is the program director of the Chester Springs Studio, which continues the tradition of art education on the same site today.
The barn was used by the Academy for painting and drawing horses and sheep and goats. Now the upstairs section of the barn, where the horses were brought in for the Academy, is now our main painting studio. The downstairs part of the barn is our ceramic studio.
The Academy closed the school in the 1950s when the art world turned to abstract and non-representational art. But a new form of art took over at Yellow Springs. The filmmaker Shorty Yeaworth moved in, made the old hospital a studio, and turned the barn into a soundstage. His company produced Christian television and short films, as well as some full-length feature films, including one which would become a cult classic called The Blob, starring Steve McQueen. When the movie makers moved on in 1973, the 8-year-old Yellow Springs Association purchased the village, which was by then listed on the National Register of Historic Places. In 1976, historic Yellow Springs was born, or reborn, its mission to bring to life the richness of its past. After so many incarnations and reincarnations, what is the role of historic Yellow Springs today? Rob Lukens says that it is to protect, preserve, and somehow tell it all.
The amazing thing for me at Yellow Springs is that the history and the science, meaning the springs themselves and the environment, and the artistic heritage are all totally intertwined.
Historic Yellow Springs Executive Director Rob Lukens ending that report by WRTI's Susan Lewis. And that's it for now. Our program written and produced by Teresa Madden and myself, with thanks also this week to Megan Smedley. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.